Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Cat Who Could Read Backwards by Lillian Jackson Braun, narrated by George Guidel. This work is copyrighted 1966 by Lillian Jackson Braun. This recording is copyrighted 1990 by Recorded Books. The world of modern art is a mystery to many. But for Jim Quillren, it turns into a mystery of another sort when his assignment to cover the art beat for his newspaper leads down the path to murder. And now, The Cat Who Could Read Backwards.
Chapter 1. Jim Quillren, whose name had confounded typesetters and proofreaders for 2 decades, arrived 15 minutes early for his appointment with the managing editor of the Daily Fluxion. In the reception room, he picked up a copy of the early edition and studied the front page. He read the weather prediction, unseasonably warm, and the circulation figures, 427,463, and the publisher's slogan snobbishly printed in Latin, Fiat Flux. He read the lead story on a murder trial, and the secondary lead on the gubernatorial race in which he found 2 typographical errors. He noticed that the art museum had failed to get its $1 million grant, but he skipped the details. He passed another feature about a kitten trapped in a drain pipe, but he read everything else. Cop nabs hood in gun tiff, probe stripper feud in loop, stocks soar as tax talk irks Dems. Quillren could hear familiar noises beyond a glass-paneled door. Typewriters clattering, teletypes jigging, telephones screaming. At the sound, his ample pepper-and-salt mustache bristled, and he smoothed it with his knuckles. Aching for a sight of the bustle and clutter that constituted the city room before a deadline, he walked to the door for a squint through the glass. The sounds were authentic, but the scene, he discovered, was all wrong. The Venetian blinds were straight. The desks were tidy and unscarred. Crumpled copy paper and slashed newspapers that should have been on the floor were collected in wire wastebaskets. As he contemplated the scene with dismay, an alien sound reached his ears, one that did not harmonize with the background music of any city rooms he had known. Then he noticed a copy boy feeding yellow pencils into a small, moaning contraption. Quillren stared at the thing. An electric pencil sharpener. He had never thought it would come to this. It reminded him how long he had been out of touch. Another copy boy in tennis shoes bounced out of the city room and said, "Mr. Quillren, you can come in now." Quillren followed him to the cubicle where a young managing editor was waiting with a sincere handshake and a sincere smile. "So you're Jim Quillren. I heard a lot about you." Quillren wondered how much and how bad. In the job resume he had mailed to the Daily Fluxion, his career traced a dubious curve. Sports writer, police reporter, war correspondent, winner of the publisher's trophy, author of a book on urban crime. Then came a succession of short-term jobs on smaller and smaller newspapers, followed by a long period of unemployment. Or no jobs worth listing. The managing editor said, "I remember your coverage of the trial that won you the publisher's trophy. I was a cub reporter at the time and a great admirer of yours." By the man's age and schooled manner, Quillren recognized him as the new breed of editor, one of the precision-honed generation who approached newspapering as a science rather than a holy cause. Quillren had always worked for the other kind, the old-fashioned, nail-spitting crusaders. The editor was saying, "With your background, you may be disappointed in our offer. All we have for you is a desk in the feature department, but we'd like you to take it until something turns up cityside."
"And until I've proved I can stay on the job?" Quillren said, looking the man in the eye.
He had been through a humbling experience. Now the problem was to strike the right chord of humility and confidence. "That goes without saying. How are you getting along?"
"So far, so good. The important thing is to get back on a newspaper. I wore out my welcome in several cities before I got smart. That's why I wanted to come here. Strange town, lively paper, new challenge. I think I can make it work."
"Sure you can," said the editor, squaring his jaw. "And here's what we have in mind for you. We need an art writer."
"An art writer?" Quillerin winced and mentally composed a headline. Vet newsman put to pasture.
Know anything about art?
Quillerin was honest. He said, I don't know the Venus de Milo from the Statue of Liberty.
You're exactly what we want. The less you know, the fresher your viewpoint. Art is booming in this town, and we need to give it more coverage. Our art critic writes a column twice a week, but we want an experienced newsman to scout stories about the artists themselves. There's plenty of material. These days, as you probably know, artists are more plentiful than cats and dogs.
Quillerin combed his mustache with his knuckles. The editor continued in a positive vein.
You report to the feature editor, but you can dig up your own assignments. We want you to get around on the beat, meet a lot of artists, shake a few hands, make friends for the paper.
Quillerin silently composed another headline. Journalist sinks to role of gladhander. But he needed the job. Necessity battled with conscience.
Well, he said, I don't know. It will be a nice, clean beat, and you'll meet some decent people for a change. You've probably had your fill of mobsters and con men.
Quillerin's twitching mustache was trying to say, who the hell wants a nice, clean beat? But its owner maintained a diplomatic silence. The editor consulted his watch and stood up.
Why don't you go upstairs and talk it over with Arch Riker? He can...
Arch Riker? What's he doing here?
He's feature editor. Know him?
We worked together in Chicago years ago.
Good, he'll give you all the details, and I hope you decide to join the flux.
The editor extended his hand and smiled, a measured smile.
Quillerin wandered out through the city room again, past the rows of white shirts with sleeves at three-quarter mast, past the heads bent obliviously over typewriters, past the inevitable girl reporter.
She was the only one who gave him an inquisitive look, and he stretched to his full 6'2", reined in the superfluous 10 pounds that pushed at his belt buckle, and passed a preening hand over his head. Like his upper lip, it still boasted 3 black hairs for every one that was gray.
Upstairs, he found Arch Riker presiding over a roomful of desks, typewriters, and telephones, all in a single shade of pea green.
Pretty fancy, isn't it? Arch said apologetically. They call it IE's olive. Everybody has to be pampered these days. Personally, I think it looks bilious. The feature department was a small addition of the city room without the smolder of urgency. Serenity filled the room like a mist. Everyone seemed to be 10 years older than the crew in the city room, and Arch himself was plumper and balder than he used to be.
Jim, it's great to see you again, he said. Do you still spell your name with that ridiculous W?
It's a respectable Scottish spelling, Quillerin protested.
And I see you haven't got rid of that overgrown mustache.
It's my only war souvenir. The knuckles smoothed it affectionately.
How's your wife, Jim?
You mean my ex-wife.
Oh, I didn't know. Sorry.
Let's skip that. What's this job you've got for me?
It's a snap. You can do a Sunday piece for us if you want to start today.
I haven't said I'll take the job yet.
You'll take it, Art said. It's just right for you.
Considering my recent reputation, you mean?
Are you going to be touchy? Forget it. Quit needling yourself.
Quillerin parted his mustache thoughtfully. I suppose I could give it a try.
Want me to do a trial assignment?
Anything you say.
Got any leads?
Yes. Arch Riker drew a pink sheet of paper from a tickler file.
How much did the boss tell you?
He didn't tell me anything, Quillerin said. Except that he wants human interest stuff on artists.
Well, he sent up a pink memo suggesting a story on a guy called Cal Halapay.
So?
Here at the Flux, we have a color code. A blue memo means for your information. Yellow means casual suggestion. But pink means jump, man, jump.
What's so urgent about Cal Halapay?
Under the circumstances, it might be better if you didn't know the background. Just go out there cold, meet this Halapay person, and write something readable. You know all the tricks.
Where do I find him?
Call his office, I suppose. He's a commercial artist and head of a successful agency, but he does oil paintings in his spare time. He paints pictures of kids. They're very popular, kids with curly hair and rosy cheeks. They look apoplectic, but people seem to buy them. Say, do you want lunch? We could go to the press club.
Quillerin's mustache sprang to attention. Once upon a time, press clubs had been his life, his love, his hobby, his home, his inspiration. This one was across the street from the new police headquarters, in a sooty limestone fortress with barred windows that had once been the county jail. The stone steps, bowl-shaped with age, held the evidence of an unseasonable February thaw. In the lobby, the ancient woodwork gleamed red under countless coats of varnish.
"We can eat in the bar," Art said, "or we can go upstairs to the dining room. They've got tablecloths up there."
"Let's eat down here," Quillerin said. It was dim and noisy in the bar. Conversation was high-key with confidential undertones. Quillerin knew it well. It meant that rumors were circulating, campaigns were being launched, and cases were getting solved, unofficially, over a beer and a hamburger. They found two empty stools at the bar and were confronted by a bartender wearing a red vest and a conspiratorial smile that brimmed with inside information. Quillerin recalled that some of his best story tips had come from press club bartenders.
"Scotch and water," Arch ordered.
Quillerin said, "Double tomato juice on the rocks."
"Tom-tom on the rocks," said the bartender. "You want a squeeze of lime and a shot of Worcestershire?"
"No, thanks."
"That's the way I fix it for my friend the mayor when he comes in here."
That was more of the authoritative smile.
"No, thanks." "How about a drop of Tabasco to give it a bite?"
"No, just pour it straight." The bartender's mouth turned down at the corners, and Arch said to him,
"This is Jim Quillerin, a new staffer. He doesn't realize you're an artist. Jim, this is Bruno. He gives his drinks a lot of personal expression."
Behind Quillerin, an ear-splitting voice said,
"I'll take less expression and a bigger shot of liquor. Hey, Bruno, make me a martini and leave out the garbage. No olive, lemon twist, anchovy, or pickled unborn tomato."
Quillerin turned and faced a cigar clamped between grinning teeth, its size vastly out of proportion to the slender young man who smoked it. The black cord hanging from his breast pocket was obviously attached to a light meter. He was noisy, he was cocky, he was enjoying himself. Quillerin liked him.
"This clown," Arch said to Quillerin, "is Odd Bunsen from the photo lab. Odd, this is Jim Quillerin, old friend of mine. We hope he's joining the Flux staff."
The photographer extended a quick hand.
"Jim, glad to meet you. Care for a cigar?"
"I use a pipe. Thanks just the same."
Odd studied Quillerin's luxuriant mustache with interest. "That shrubbery's getting out of hand. Aren't you afraid of brush fires?"
Arch said to Quillerin, "The black string hanging out of Mr. Bunsen's pocket is what we use to tie his head on. But he's a useful man. He has more information than the reference library. Maybe he can fill you in on Cal Halapay."
"Sure," said the photographer. "What do you want to know? He's got a sharp-looking wife, 34-22-32.
"Who is this Halapay, anyway?" Quillerin asked.
Odd Bunsen consulted his cigar smoke briefly. "Commercial artist, runs a big ad agency, personally worth a few million. Lives in Lost Lake Hills, beautiful house, big studio where he paints, 2 swimming pools, 2. Did you get that? With water being so scarce, he probably fills one with bourbon."
"Any family?"
2 or 3 kids, gorgeous wife. Halapay owns an island in the Caribbean and a ranch in Oregon and a couple of private planes. Everything money can buy, and he's not tight with his dough. He's a good Joe."
"What about these pictures he paints?"
"Sharp, real sharp," said Odd. "I've got one hanging in my living room. After I photographed Halapay's wife at a charity ball last fall, he gave me a painting, a couple of kids with curly hair. Well, I've got to go and eat now. There's a 1 o'clock assignment on the board."
Arch drained his drink and said to Quillerin,
"Talk to Halapay and size up the photo possibilities, and then we'll try to assign Odd Bunsen. He's our best man. Maybe he could try some color shots. It wouldn't hurt to do this layout in color."
"That pink memo has you straining a bit, hasn't it?" Quillerin said. "What's the connection between Halapay and the Daily Fluxion?"
"I'm having another drink," Art said. "Want another tomato juice?"
Quillerin let the question drop, but he said, "Just give me one straight answer, Arch. Why are they offering me this art beat, me, of all people?"
"Because that's the way newspapers do things. They assign baseball experts as drama critics and church news writers to the nightclub beat. You know that as well as I do."
Quillerin nodded and stroked his mustache sadly. Then he said, "What about this art critic you have on the staff? If I take the job, do I work with him? Or her, as the case may be?"
"It's a guy," Arch told him. "He writes critical reviews, and you'll be doing straight reporting and personality stories. I don't think there'll be any conflict."
"Does he work in our department?"
No, he never comes to the office. He does his column at home, puts it on tape, and sends it down by messenger once or twice a week. We have to transcribe it. It's a fat nuisance.
What keeps him away? Doesn't he like pea green?
Don't ask me. That's his arrangement with the front office. He has a neat contract with the Flux.
What's the fellow like?
Aloof, opinionated, hard to get along with.
That's nice. Is he young or old?
In between. He lives alone, with a cat, if you can picture that. A lot of people think the cat writes the column, and they may be right.
Is his stuff any good?
He thinks so, and the brass evidently thinks so.
Arch shifted around on the barstool while he weighed his next remark.
There's a rumor that the Flux has the guy heavily insured.
What's so valuable about an art critic?
This one's got that certain magic that newspapers love. He's controversial. His column pulls hundreds of letters a week, no thousands.
What kind of letters?
Angry ones, sugary ones, hysterical ones. The arty readers hate his guts. The others think he's the greatest, and they get to brawling among themselves. He manages to keep the whole city stirred up. Do you know what our last survey showed? The art page has a bigger readership than the sports section. Now you know, and I know, that's an unnatural situation.
You must have a lot of art buffs in this town, Quillerman said.
You don't have to like art to enjoy our art column. You just have to like blood.
But what do they fight about?
You'll find out.
I can understand controversy in sports and politics, but art is art, isn't it?
That's what I used to think, said Arch. When I took over the feature desk, I had this simple-minded notion that art was something precious, for beautiful people who had beautiful thoughts. Man, did I lose that dream in a hurry. Art has gone democratic. In this town, it's the greatest fad since Canasta, and anybody can play. People buy paintings instead of swimming pools.
Quillerin chewed the ice in his tomato juice and pondered the mysteries of this beat the Daily Fluxion was offering him.
By the way, he said, what's the critic's name?
George Bonifield Mount Clemens.
Say that again, please.
George Bonifield Mount Clemens, the third.
That's a stickful. Does he use all three names like that?
All three names, all nine syllables, all 28 letters plus the numerals.
Twice a week we try to fit his byline into a standard column width. It can't be done except sideways, and he doesn't permit any abbreviations, hyphens, contractions, or amputations. Quillerin gave Arch a close look.
You don't like him much, do you?
Arch shrugged.
I can take him or leave him. Actually, I never see the guy. I just see the artists who come to the office wanting to punch him in the teeth.
George Bonifield Mount Clemens III.
Quillerin shook his head in amazement. Even his name infuriates some of our readers, Arch said. They want to know who does he think he is.
Keep talking. I'm beginning to like this job. The boss said it was a nice, wholesome beat, and I was afraid I'd be working with a bunch of saints.
Don't let him kid you. All the artists in this town hate each other, and all the art lovers take sides. Then everybody plays rough. It's like football, only dirtier. Name-calling, backbiting, double-crossing.
Arch slid off his barstool.
Come on, let's get a corned beef sandwich.
The blood of several old war horses that flowed through Quillerin's veins began to churn a little faster. His mustache almost smiled.
Okay, I'll take it, he said. I'll take the job.
Chapter 2. It was Quillerin's first day on the job at the Daily Fluxion. He moved into one of the pea-green desks in the feature department and got himself a supply of yellow pencils. He noticed that the pea-green telephone was stenciled with an official reminder, "Be nice to people." He tried the pea-green typewriter by poking out, "The time of many murders is after midnight." Then he telephoned the Fluxion garage to request a staff car for the trip to Lost Lake Hills. To reach the fashionable exurb 15 miles beyond the city limits, Quillerin drove through complacent suburbs and past winter-brown farms patched with snow. He had plenty of time to think about this interview with Cal Halapay, and he wondered if the Quillerin method would still work. In the old days, he had been famous for a brotherly approach that put interviewees at ease. It was composed of two parts sympathy, two parts professional curiosity, and one part low blood pressure. And it had won confidences from old ladies, juvenile delinquents, pretty girls, college presidents,
and crooks. Nevertheless, he felt qualms about the Halepay assignment. It had been a long time since he had done an interview, and artists were not his specialty. He suspected they spoke a secret language. On the other hand, Halepay was an advertising executive, and he might hand over a mimeographed release prepared by his public relations office. Quillerin's mustache shuddered. It had always been the newsman's habit to compose the opening paragraph of his story in advance. It never worked, but he did it as a limbering-up exercise. Now, on the road to Lost Lake Hills, he made a few starts at the Halepay story. He thought he might say, "When Cal Halepay leaves his plush executive suite at the end of the day, he forgets the cutthroat competition of the advertising rat race and finds relaxation in..." No, that was trite. He tried again. "A multimillionaire advertising man with a beautiful wife, 34, 22, 32, and two swimming pools, one filled with champagne, according to legend, admits he lives a double life. In painting poignant portraits of children, he escapes..." No, that was sensationalism. Quillerin recalled his brief employment with a news magazine and made another attempt in the crunchy style favored by that publication. With an ascot folded in the throat line of his custom-made Italian silk sports shirt, the handsome, graying, 6'2" czar of an advertising empire spends his spare time. Quillerin guessed that a man of Halepay's accomplishments must be that tall, that gray, and that impressive. He would probably have a winter tan as well. With a blue foulard ascot accentuating his Caribbean tan, Lost Lake Road ended abruptly at a massive iron gate set in a fieldstone wall that looked impregnable and expensive. Quillerin braked the car and glanced around for signs of a caretaker. Almost immediately, a recorded voice coming from the gatepost said pleasantly, "Please face the pylon at your left and announce your name clearly." He rolled down the car window and said, "Quillerin from the Daily Fluxion." "Thank you," murmured the gatepost. The gate swung open, and the newsman drove into the estate, following a road that meandered through a tall stand of pines. It ended in a severely landscaped winter garden, all pebbles, boulders, and evergreens, with arched bridges crossing small frozen ponds. In this setting, bleak but picturesque, stood a rambling house. It was contemporary in style, with gently curving roof lines and opaque glass walls that looked like rice paper. Quillerin revised his opening line about the Italian sports shirt. Halepay probably knocked around his million-dollar pagoda in a silk kimono. At the entrance door, which appeared to be carved out of ivory, Quillerin found something that resembled a doorbell and reached toward it, but before his finger touched the button, the surrounding panel glowed with a blue-green light and chimes could be heard indoors. These were followed by the bark of a dog, or two, or three. There was a sharp command, a moment of silent obedience, and a briskly opened door. "Good morning, I'm Quillerin from the Daily Fluxion," the newsman said to a curly-haired, pink-faced youth in sweatshirt and dungarees, and before he could add, "Is your father home?" the young man said amiably, "Come in, sir, here's your passport." He handed over a fuzzy snapshot of a heavily mustached face, peering anxiously from the window of a car. "That's me," said Quillerin in astonishment. "Taken at the gate before you drove in," the young man said with obvious delight. "It's spooky, isn't it? Here, let me take your topcoat. I hope you don't mind the dogs. They're sort of friendly. They love visitors. This one is the mother. She's 4 years old. The pups are from her last litter. Do you like blue terriers?" Quillerin said, "Everyone wants Yorkshires these days, but I like the Kerry Blues. They've got beautiful coats, haven't they? Did you have any trouble finding the place? We have a cat, too, but she's pregnant, and she sleeps all the time. I think it's going to snow. I hope so. The skiing has been lousy this year." Quillerin, who prided himself on conducting interviews without making notes, was taking mental inventory of the house. White marble foyer with fish pool and tropical tree, probably 14 feet high. Skylight 2 stories overhead. Sunken living room carpeted with something like white raccoon. Fireplace in a shiny black wall, probably onyx. He noticed also that the boy had a hole in his sleeve and was padding around in sweat socks. The flow of chatter had not ceased. "Would you like to sit in the living room, Mr. Quillerin? Or do you want to go right to the studio? It's more comfortable in the studio if you don't mind the smell. Some people are allergic to turpentine. Would you like a Coke or something? Allergies are funny things." I'm allergic to crustaceans. That burns me up because I'm crazy about lobster. Quillerman was waiting for a chance to say, "Is your father home?" when the young man said, "My secretary tells me you want to do a story on my paintings. Let's go into my studio. Do you want to ask questions or shall I just talk?" Quillerman gulped and said, "Frankly, I was expecting you to be a much older..." "I'm a boy wonder," said Halapay without smiling. "I made my first million before I was 21. I'm 29 now. I seem to have a genius for making money. Do you believe in genius? It's spooky, really. Here's a picture of me when I was married. My wife looks oriental, doesn't she? She's out taking an art lesson this morning, but you'll meet her after lunch. We designed the house to go with her looks. Would you like some coffee? I'll stir up the housekeeper if you want coffee. Let's face it, I look boyish, and I always will. There's a bar in the studio if you'd rather have a drink." The studio had a painty aroma, a good deal of clutter, and one vast wall of glass overlooking a white frozen lake. Halapay flicked a switch, and a filmy shade unfolded from the ceiling to screen out the glare. He touched another control, and doors glided open to reveal a bigger liquor supply than the press club had on its back bar. Quillerman said he preferred coffee, so Halapay pressed a button and gave the order to a brass grill mounted on the wall. He also handed Quillerman an odd-shaped bottle from the bar. "This is a liqueur I brought back from South America," he said. "You can't buy it here. Take it home with you. How do you like the view from this window? Sensational, isn't it? That's a man-made lake. The landscaping alone cost me half a million. Do you want a donut with your coffee? These are my paintings on the wall. Do you like them?" The studio walls were covered with framed canvases, portraits of small boys and girls with curly hair and cheeks like red apples. Everywhere Quillerman looked, there were red apples. "Pick out a painting," said Halapay, "and take it home with you. Compliments of the artist. The large ones sell for $500. Take a big one. Do you have any kids?" "We have two girls. That's their picture on the stereo cabinet. Cindy is 8 and Susan is 6. Quillerman studied the photograph of Halapay's daughters. Like their mother, they had almond eyes and classically straight hair, and he said, "How come you paint nothing but children with curly hair and rosy cheeks?" "You should go to the Valentine Ball on Saturday night. We're having a great jazz combo. Do you know about the ball? It's the annual Valentine party at the art club. We're all going in costume representing famous lovers. Would you like to go? You don't have to dress up if masquerading doesn't appeal to you. It's $20 a couple. Here, let me give you a pair of tickets." "Getting back to your paintings," said Quillerman, "I'm curious to know why you specialize in kids. Why not landscapes?" "I think you should write up the ball in your column," Halapay said. "It's the biggest event of the year at the club. I'm chairman, and my wife's very photogenic. Do you like art? Everyone in the art field will be there." "Including George Bonifield Mount Clemens III, I suppose," said Quillerman, in a tone intended to be jocular. Without any change in his expressionless delivery, Halapay said, "That fraud, if that fraud showed his face in the outer lobby of the club, they'd throw him out. I hope he isn't a close friend of yours. I have no use for that character. He doesn't know anything about art, but he poses as an authority, and your paper lets him crucify established artists. They're letting him corrupt the entire art atmosphere of the city. They should get smart and unload him." "I'm new on this beat," said Quillerman, as Halapay stopped for breath. "And I'm no expert. Just to prove what a fraud your critic is, he builds up Zoe Lambreth as a great artist. Did you ever see her stuff? It's a hoax. You go and see her paintings at the Lambreth Gallery, and you'll see what I mean. No reputable gallery would accept her work, so she had to marry an art dealer. There are tricks in all trades. As for her husband, he's nothing but a bookkeeper who got into the art racket, and I do mean racket. Here comes Tom with the coffee." A houseboy dressed in soiled chinos and a half-buttoned shirt appeared with a tray which he banged down on a table with a lack of grace. He gave Quillerman an unfriendly stare. Halapay said, "I wonder if we ought to have a sandwich with this. It's almost lunchtime. What do you want to know about my work? Go ahead and ask some questions. Don't you want to make notes?"
"I'd like to know," said Quillerman, "why you specialize in painting children."
The artist lapsed into a thoughtful silence, his first since Quillerin's arrival. Then he said, "Zoe Lambreth seems to have this big connection with Mount Clemens. It would be interesting to know how she manages it."
"I could make a few guesses, not for publication."
"Why don't you dig into the situation? You might come up with a juicy exposé and get Mount Clemens fired. Then you could be art critic."
"I don't want," Quillerin began.
"If your paper doesn't clean up that mess, and clean it up soon, they're going to start feeling it where it hurts. I wouldn't mind a hot dog with this coffee. Do you want a hot dog?"
At 5:30 that afternoon, Quillerin fled to the warm, varnished sanctuary of the press club, where he had agreed to meet Arch Riker. Arch wanted a quick drink on the way home. Quillerin wanted an explanation. He told Bruno curtly, "Tomato juice on the rocks, no lime, no Worcestershire, no Tabasco." To Arch he said, "Thanks, pal, thanks for the welcome celebration."
"What do you mean? Was that an initiation gag?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"I'm talking about that assignment to interview Cal Halapay. Was that a practical joke?"
"You couldn't have been serious. The guy's a nut."
Arch said, "Well, you know how artists are, individualists. What happened?"
"Nothing happened. Nothing I could possibly use in a story, and it took 6 hours to find it out. Halapay lives in this rambling house, about the size of a junior high school, only it's sort of Japanese, and it's wired to do all kinds of tricks. The inside is wild. There's one wall made of glass rods hanging like icicles. They move when you walk past and sound like a xylophone that needs tuning."
"Well, why not? He's got to spend his dough somehow."
"I know, but wait till I finish. There's all this expensive stage setting, and then out comes Cal Halapay padding around in stocking feet and wearing a sweatshirt with a big hole in the elbow. And he looks about 15 years old."
"Yes, I've heard he's youthful looking for a millionaire," Arch said.
"That's another thing. He keeps boasting about his money and trying to force presents on you. I had to fight off cigars, liquor, a $500 painting, a frozen turkey from his ranch in Oregon, and a Kerry Blue puppy. After lunch, his wife showed up, and I was afraid his generosity would exceed the bounds of propriety. Incidentally, Mrs. Halapay is quite a dish."
"You're making me envious. What did you have for lunch, ostrich tongues?"
"Hot dogs, served by a houseboy with the charm of a gorilla."
"You got a free lunch. What are you griping about?"
"Halapay, he won't answer questions."
"He refuses?" Arch asked in surprise.
"He ignores them. You can't pin him down. He wanders from progressive jazz to primitive masks he collected in Peru to pregnant cats. I had more luck communicating with the gatepost than with that boy Wonder."
"Did you get anything at all?"
"I saw his paintings, of course, and I found out about a blast the art club is giving on Saturday night. I think I might go."
"What did you think of his paintings?"
"They're slightly monotonous, all those red apple cheeks. But I made a discovery in all those pictures of kids. Cal Halapay is painting himself. I think he's enchanted with his own looks, curly hair, pink complexion."
Arch said, "I agree this isn't going to make the kind of story the boss wants. It sounds like the Arabian Nights."
"Do we have to run a story?"
"You saw the color of the memo, pink."
Quillerin massaged his mustache. After a while he said, "The only time I got a direct answer to a question was when I mentioned George Bonifield Mount Clemens."
Arch put down his drink. "What did Halapay say?"
"He exploded, in a controlled sort of way. Basically, he says Mount Clemens isn't qualified to judge art."
"That figures. Halapay had a one-man show about a year ago, and now a critic roasted him alive. The readers loved it. It cheered their black hearts to know that a successful money man could be a failure at something. But it was a bitter blow to Halapay. He discovered his money could buy anything but a good art review.
I weep for him."
"What about the other newspaper? Did they criticize his work, too?"
"They don't have a critic. Just a nice old lady reporter who covers the art openings and gushes about everything. They played safe."
Quillerin said, "So Halapay's a bad sport?"
"Yes."
"And you don't know how bad," said Arch, pulling his barstool closer to Quillerin's. "Ever since that episode, he's been trying to bankrupt the Flux. He's withdrawn a lot of advertising lineage and switched it over to the other paper. That hurts, especially since he controls most of the food and fashion advertising in town. He's even trying to turn other ad men against the Flux. It's serious."
Quillerin grimaced in disbelief.
And I'm supposed to write a story buttering up that skunk so the advertising department can get the lineage back again? Frankly, it would help. It would take the heat off. I don't like it.
Don't go fastidious on me, Arch pleaded. Just write a folksy piece about an interesting guy who wears old clothes around the house, takes his shoes off, keeps cats and dogs, eats wieners for lunch. You know how to do it.
I don't like it.
I'm not asking you to lie. Just be selective, that's all. Skip the part about the glass icicles and the $500,000 lake and the visits in South America and bear down on the turkey farm and his lovely wife and the adorable kitties.
Quillerin brooded over it.
I suppose that's called practical newspapering. It helps pay the bills.
I don't like it, said Quillerin. But if you're in that bad of a bind, I'll see what I can do. He raised his tomato juice glass. Halapay or hell to pay.
Don't be cute. I've had a hard day.
I'd like to read some of Mount Clemens' reviews. Have you got them around?
On file in the library, Arch said.
I want to see what he wrote about an artist named Zoe Lambreth. Halapay hinted at a shady connection between Mrs. Lambreth and Mount Clemens. Know anything about that?
I just process his copy. I don't peek under his window shades, said Arch.
And he gave Quillerin a good night slap on the back. Chapter 3. Quillerin, wearing the newer and darker of his two suits, went alone to the Valentine Ball at the Art Club, which he discovered was called the Turp and Chisel. The club had originated 40 years before in the back room of a Blind Pig. Now it occupied the top floor of the best hotel. Its membership was large and fashionable, and the impecunious bohemians who had founded the fraternity had become old, staid, and full of dollars. Upon his arrival at the ball, Quillerin was able to wander unrecognized about the premises of the Turp and Chisel. He found a sumptuous lounge, a dining room, and a very busy bar. The games room, paneled with old barnwood, offered everything from darts to dominoes. In the ballroom, tables were draped with red and white cloths, and an orchestra played innocuous tunes. He asked for the Halapay table and was greeted by Sandra Halapay wearing a white kimono of stiff embroidered silk. Exaggerated makeup made her almond eyes even more exotic.
"I was afraid you wouldn't come," she said, holding his hand long after the handshake had ended and delighting him with a rippling laugh.
"The invitation was irresistible, Mrs. Halapay," said Quillerin.
Then he surprised himself by bending over her hand and brushing it with his mustache. "Please call me Sandy," she said. "Did you come alone? To a lover's ball?"
"Yes, I represent Narcissus."
Sandy trilled with merriment. "You newspaper people are so clever."
She was lyrically tall and lovely, Quillerin decided, and tonight she was charmingly relaxed, as wives often are when their husbands are absent.
"Cal is chairman of the ball," she said, "and he's flitting around so you can be my date." Her eyes were roguish as well as exotic.
Then Sandy, changing to a formal tone that rang hollow, introduced the others who were seated at the table. They were members of Cal's committee, she explained pointedly. A Mr. and Mrs. Riggs, or Biggs, were in French period costume. A short, fleshy couple named Bookwalter, who seemed to be having a dull time, were garbed as peasants. There was also May Sizzler, art reporter from the other newspaper. Quillerin gave her a fraternal bow, at the same time estimating that she was 10 years past retirement age. May Sizzler gave him a bony hand and said in a thin voice,
"Your Mr. Mount Clemens is a very naughty boy, but you look like a nice young man."
"Thank you," said Quillerin. "No one has called me a young man for 20 years."
"You'll like your new job," she predicted. "You'll meet lovely people."
Sandy leaned close to Quillerin and said, "You look so romantic in that mustache. I wanted Cal to grow one so he would look halfway grown up, but he resisted the suggestion. He looks like such an infant, don't you think so?" She laughed musically. Quillerin said, "It's true, he appears youthful."
"I think he's retarded somehow. In another few years people will think he's my son. Won't that be crushing?"
Sandy gave Quillerin an adoring look.
"Are you going to ask me to dance? Cal is a terrible dancer. He thinks he's a killer, but he's really a clod on the dance floor."
"Can you dance in that costume?" Sandy's stiff white kimono was bound about the middle with a wide black obi.
More white silk was draped over her straight, dark hair.
"Oh, sure,"
she squeezed Quillerin's arm as they walked to the dance floor. "Do you know what my costume represents?" Quillerin said no. "Cal's in a black kimono. We're the young lovers in a snowy landscape."
"Who are they?"
"Oh, you know, the famous print by Harunobu."
"Sorry, I'm a dunce when it comes to art."
Quillerin felt he could be debonair about the admission because at that moment he was leading Sandy expertly through a foxtrot enhanced by a few Quillerin flourishes.
"You're a fun dancer," she said. "It takes real coordination to foxtrot to a cha-cha. But we must do something about your art education. Would you like me to tutor you?"
"I don't know if I could afford you on my salary," he said. And Sandy's laughter could be heard above the orchestra. "How about the little lady from the other newspaper? Is she an art expert?"
"Her husband was a camouflage artist in World War I," said Sandy. "I guess that makes her an expert."
"And who are the rest of the people at your table?"
"Riggs is a sculptor. He does stringy, emaciated things that are shown at the Lambeth Gallery. They look like grasshoppers."
"So does Riggs, when you come to think of it. The other couple, the Bookwalters, are supposed to be Picasso's famous pair of lovers. You can't tell they're in costume. They always dress like peasants."
Sandy turned up her nicely tilted nose. "I can't stand her. She thinks she's such an egghead. Her husband teaches art at Peniman School, and he's having a one-man show at the West Side Gallery. He's a vegetable, but he does lovely watercolors."
Then she frowned. "I hope newspaper men aren't eggheads. When Cal told me to... Oh, well, never mind. I talk too much. Let's just dance."
Quillerin lost his partner shortly after when a surly young man cut in. He was wearing a torn T-shirt and had the manners of a hoodlum. The face was familiar. Later, back at the table, Sandy said, "That was Tom, our houseboy. He's supposed to be Stanley... what's his name, from that Tennessee Williams play, and his date is around here somewhere dressed in a pink negligee. Tom is a boor, but Cal thinks he has talent, and so he's putting the kid through art school. Cal does a lot of wonderful things. You're going to write an article about him, aren't you?"
"If I can collect enough material," said Quillerin. "He's difficult to interview. Perhaps you could help me."
"I'd love it. Did you know Cal is chairman of the State Council on Art? I think he wants to be the first professional artist to make the White House. He'll probably get there, too. He lets nothing stop him."
She paused and became thoughtful.
"You ought to write an article about the old man at the next table."
"Who's he?"
"They call him Uncle Waldo. He's a retired butcher who paints animals. He never held a paintbrush until he was 69.
"Where have I heard that before?" Quillerin said.
"Oh, sure, every senior citizen wants to be a Grandma Moses, but Uncle Waldo is really talented, even if Georgie doesn't think so."
"Who's Georgie?"
"You know Georgie, your precious art critic."
"I haven't met the man yet. What's he like?"
"He's a real stinker, that's what he's like. When he reviewed Uncle Waldo's one-man show, he was absolutely cruel."
"What did he say?"
"He said Uncle Waldo should go back to operating a meat market and leave the cows and bunny rabbits to kids who draw them with more imagination and honesty. He said Uncle Waldo butchered more livestock on canvas than he ever did in the meat business." Everyone was furious. Lots of people wrote letters to the editor, but the poor old man took it hard and stopped painting. It was a crime. He used to paint very charming primitives. I understand his grandson, who's a truck driver, went to the newspaper office and threatened to beat up George Bonifield Mount Clemens, and I don't blame him. Your critic is completely irresponsible."
"Has he ever reviewed your husband's work?"
Quillerin asked with his best expression of innocence. Sandy shuddered.
"He's written some vicious things about Cal, just because Cal is a commercial artist and successful. Mount Clemens classifies commercial artists with house painters and paper hangers. Actually, Cal can draw better than any of those arty, blotch-and-dribble kids who call themselves abstract expressionists. Not one of them could draw a glass of water."
Sandy frowned and fell silent. And Quillerin said,
"You're prettier when you smile."
She obliged with a burst of laughter.
"Look, isn't that a panic? Cal is dancing with Mark Antony."
Quillerin followed her pointing finger to the dance floor, where Cal Halapay in black Japanese kimono was guiding a husky Roman warrior through a slow foxtrot. The face under Antony's helmet was bold-featured but soft.
"That's Butchie Bolton," said Sandy. "She teaches sculpture at the art school, welded metal and all that sort of thing. She and her roommate came as Antony and Cleopatra. Isn't that a scream? Butchie welded her own armor. It looks like a couple of truck fenders."
Quillerin said, "The paper should have sent a photographer. We should be getting pictures of all this."
Sandy did some acrobatics with her eyebrows and said, "Zoe Lambreth was supposed to handle publicity for the ball, but I guess she's only good at getting publicity for herself."
"I'm going to phone the picture desk," said Quillerin, "and see if they'll send over a man."
Half an hour later, Odd Bunsen, who was working the 1-to-11 shift, arrived with a 35mm reflex camera hanging around his neck and the usual cigar between his teeth. Quillerin met him in the foyer and said, "Be sure to get a good shot of Cal and Sandra Halape." Odd said, "You're telling me? They love to get their noodles in the paper."
"Try to get everybody in pairs. They're dressed up as famous lovers, Othello and Desdemona, Lolita and Humbert, Adam and Eve."
"Crazy," said Odd Bunsen as he readied his camera. "How long do you have to hang around here, Jim?"
"Just long enough to see who wins the costume prizes and phone something into the desk."
"Why don't you meet me at the press club for a nightcap? I can quit after I print these."
Back at the Halape table, Sandy introduced Quillerin to an impressive woman in a beaded evening dress.
"Mrs. Duxbury," Sandy explained, "is the most important collector in the city. You should write an article about her collection. It's 18th-century English, Gainsborough and Reynolds, you know."
Mrs. Duxbury said, "I'm not anxious to have my collection publicized, Mr. Quillerin, unless it will help you personally in your new position. Frankly, I am overjoyed to welcome you among us."
Quillerin bowed. "Thank you. It's a completely new field for me."
"I trust your presence here means that the Daily Fluxion has at last come to its senses and dropped Mount Clemens?"
"No," said Quillerin. "We're simply expanding our coverage. Mount Clemens will continue to write critical reviews."
"What a pity. We were all hoping the newspaper would dismiss that horrid man."
A fanfare of trumpets from the stage announced the presentation of costume prizes, and Sandy said to Quillerin, "I've got to collect Cal for the judging and the grand march. Are you sure you won't stay longer?"
"Sorry, I have to file my copy, but don't forget you're going to help me write a profile on your husband."
"I'll phone you and invite myself to lunch," said Sandy, giving the newsman an affectionate hug. "It will be fun."
Quillerin moved to the back of the room and jotted down names as the winners were announced, and he was looking for a telephone when a woman's voice, soft and low, said, "Aren't you the new man from the Daily Fluxion?" His mustache tingled. Women's voices sometimes affected him that way, and this voice was like caressing fingers.
"I'm Zoe Lambreth," she said, "and I'm afraid I failed miserably in my assignment. I was supposed to notify the newspapers about this ball, and it slipped my mind completely. I'm getting ready for a one-man show and working awfully hard, if you'll accept a lame excuse. I hope you're not being neglected. Are you getting all the information you need?"
"I think so. Mrs. Halape has been looking after me."
"Yes, I noticed," Zoe said with a slight tightening of well-shaped lips.
"Mrs. Halape was very helpful."
Zoe's eyebrows flickered. "I dare say."
"You're not in costume, Mrs. Lambreth."
"No. My husband didn't care to come tonight, and I just dropped in for a few minutes. I wish you would visit the Lambreth Gallery someday and meet my husband. Both of us would like to help you in any way we can."
"I'm going to need help. This is brand new territory for me," Quillerin said, and then slyly he added, "Mrs. Halape has offered to supervise my art education."
"Oh, dear," said Zoe with an intonation that suggested mild distress.
"Don't you approve?"
"Well, Sandra is not the most knowledgeable of authorities. Forgive me, sooner or later you'll find out that artists are notorious cats."
Zoe's large brown eyes were being disarmingly frank, and Quillerin drowned in them momentarily.
"But I'm really sincere in my concern for you," she went on. "I wouldn't want to see you misdirected. Much of the work being produced today in the name of art is spurious at its worst and shoddy at its best. You should insist on knowing the credentials of your advisors."
"What would you suggest?"
"Come and visit the Lambreth Gallery," she urged, and her eyes echoed the invitation.
Quillerin pulled in his waistline and entertained the idea of losing a few pounds beginning tomorrow. Then he made another attempt to find a telephone.
The grand march was over and the guests were circulating. Word had spread about the club that the Daily Fluxion's new reporter was attending the party and that he was easily recognized by his prominent mustache. Consequently, numerous strangers approached Quillerin and introduced themselves. Each one wished him well and followed with something uncomplimentary about George Bonifield Mount Clemens. Those who were art dealers added brief commercials for their galleries. Artists mentioned their forthcoming exhibitions. The layman invited Quillerin to come and see their private collections any time and to bring a photographer if he wished. Among those who hailed the newsman was Cal Halapay. "Come out to the house for dinner some evening," he said. "Bring the whole family." Now the drinking commenced in earnest, and the party grew boisterous. The greatest commotion could be heard in the games room, and Quillerin followed the crowd in that direction. He found the room packed with laughing guests, standing rib to rib with barely enough room to raise a highball glass, and the center of attention was Mark Antony. She was standing on a chair. Without a helmet, Mark Antony was more nearly a woman, pudgy-faced, with a short haircut set in tight waves. "Step right up, folks," she was barking. "Try your skill." Quillerin squeezed into the room. The crowd, he discovered, was focusing its attention on a game of darts. Players were trying their aim at a life-size sketch of a man chalked on the barn wood wall with all features of the anatomy explicitly delineated. "Step right up, folks," the woman warrior was chanting. "Doesn't cost a cent. One chance apiece. Who wants to play kill the critic?" Quillerin decided he had had enough. His mustache was feeling vaguely uncomfortable. He made a discreet exit, telephoned his story to the paper, and then joined Odd Bunsen at the press club. "Mount Clemens must be a pill," he said to the photographer. "Do you read his column?" "Who reads?" said Odd. "I just look at the pictures and check my credit line." "He seems to cause a lot of trouble. Do you know anything about the situation at the art museum?" "I know they've got a cute chick in the check room," Odd said, "and some crazy nudes on the second floor." "Interesting, but that's not what I mean. The museum just lost a $1 million grant from some foundation, and the director was fired as a result. That's what I heard at the party tonight, and they say the whole ruckus was caused by the Daily Fluxion's critic." "I wouldn't doubt it. He's always raising hell in the photo lab. He phones in and tells us what he wants photographed for his column. Then we have to go to the galleries to make the pics. You should see the garbage he expects us to photograph. Last week I went back to the Lambeth Gallery twice, and I still couldn't get a shot worth printing." "How come?" "The painting was black and navy blue, for Pete's sake. My print looked like a coal bin on a dark night, and the boss thought it was my fault. Old Monty's always beefing about our photographs. If I ever get a chance, I'd like to bust a speed graphic over his skull."
This ends Disc 1.